Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, when Americans think the food scene, we think restaurants, recipes, TV shows, chefs, but the rest of the world is dabbling in much deeper waters. Prime example, the British hedge funds manager who bought up all the cocoa beans in Europe, as in $1 billion worth, or the equivalent of 5 billion candy bars. Scotland has been able to get 55% alcohol into a beer glass, and it sells for $1,000 a pop. And in Japan, there's a TV show where celebrities award top stars to places where your feet stick to the floor. But the food's great. Just a reminder of how food's changing all over. Stay with us. There's more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. When you've got someone whose job it is to travel the world, I'm curious to know, when given a choice, which places call them back again and again. Peter John Lindbergh is one of those people who can go anywhere he wants. He's the editor of Travel and Leisure magazine, and the place that keeps bringing him back year after year is Vietnam. Peter, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Where should we begin in Vietnam? Should we begin in the north or in the south?
Well, most travelers typically start their trip in Hanoi, which is really a profoundly beautiful city and probably the best introduction to the country. There's been a great deal of change in Vietnam since the economy opened up, of course, but Hanoi is still this wonderfully timeless old world city with a great deal of French and Chinese architecture still intact. So you can lose yourself down some little back lane and feel like it's 1898, you know.
And this is North Vietnam.
This is in the north of Vietnam. And what's interesting about Hanoi is that the climate there really does inform the cuisine. It's a surprisingly kind of wintry, often very chilly, kind of wet and rainy, misty kind of town. So here's the place where you really are craving that kind of earthy, hearty, cockle-warming food. And the best example of that, of course, is Vietnam's national dish, which is pho, which here in the States we're aware of that, but you've never had anything like that until you've gone to Hanoi, which is really the capital for pho. There they eat it morning, noon, and night. It's actually preferred for breakfast, and if you have it for breakfast, the rest of your day is just guaranteed to be good.
I think you've got to describe what pho is, because I think there are people who haven't had it. But more importantly, what is it in Hanoi?
Well, in Hanoi, it's typically a beef broth. It starts with this wonderfully rich, deliciously long-simmered beef broth that's often cooked overnight. And it's sort of shot through and infused with all sorts of herbs and spices, most obviously star anise, ginger, clove. So it's got this real depth to it, especially the longer it's cooked. And then right before serving, you add a tangle of rice noodles, rice vermicelli, a few fresh scallions, and then typically a few strips of raw beef, which cook in the broth, but just barely, so they're still a little pink, just for the last minute or so. Now, down in the south, they'll add fresh basil and mint and bean sprouts and sometimes some chilies.
That's what we see here, where there's a salad. They call it a table salad. All these things come on the side.
Exactly. Yeah, you'll get the what they call the hedgerow on the side. But in the north, it's a little more simple. They might put a squirt of rice vinegar or a little squirt of lime on there. But basically, it's all about the soup itself, which is this amazingly earthy and beefy broth. And it costs less than a dollar. It's like Vietnamese penicillin.
What should we expect? How do you dine in Vietnam?
Well, remember that a proper restaurant culture in Vietnam is really very young there. It really only started in the late 80s and early 90s with the free market reforms. and the rise of the middle class. And it's still, you know, sort of gestating. I mean, food is found everywhere, on every corner, but it's usually in street stalls and sidewalk kitchens and these kind of impromptu little braziers and cooking stalls that are set up on the street. So until now, it's been quite hard to find a good food in formal sit-down restaurants with a nice, pleasant atmosphere. And the food just generally isn't that inspired when you do find those places.
Right.
So the best food is generally served in the least attractive-looking little canteens on plastic, flimsy tables on the sidewalks. In fact, I have a little rule of thumb about eating out in Vietnam. If they have fluorescent lighting, that's generally a good sign and you want to have dinner there. If they have incandescent lighting and votives on the tables, maybe just stop in for a drink, you know, but maybe don't order a meal. And what's great about these little humble sidewalk places is that, you know, it's all incredibly fresh and it's, you know, all of it was plucked that morning or harvested that morning or cooked that, you know, the night before. So they're generally safe to eat at. And all my years of eating in Vietnam, I've never once gotten sick from street food, which, of course, is a concern for a lot of travelers.
What else should we seek out?
Well, if you go down south from Hanoi, it's sort of the opposite of Hanoi. If that's sort of more like a Boston or a New York, then Saigon is like Miami. You know, it's this tropical, sun-drenched, hot, teeming city. And it really is the gateway to Vietnam. It always has been for centuries. It's been a trade center, so therefore it's much more open to the world. And as a result, the people, the culture, and the cuisine is much more cosmopolitan and has a lot more influences. Most particularly, the Indian and the Malay influence is much more prevalent in Saigon in the south. So you'll find things like curries, coconut milk, mm-hmm. hot chilies, tropical fruits. And one of the great examples of a Saigon dish, one of the favorite dishes there, is called ban sao, which means sizzling crepe. This is sort of a derivation of an Indian dosa, if people are familiar with that.
The big pancake that's made out of sort of a fermented rice batter. It's the size of a wheel.
It is. It overwhelms the table it's on. You know, it's cooked up in a wok, and it's usually infused with turmeric. So it's got this big, bright, orangey-yellow color. And then you fill it up with shrimp or pork or bean sprouts or mushrooms. And then the best thing about it is you get this sort of a tumbleweed of basil and mint and mustard greens and lettuce on the side of the thing that comes on the table. And then you just help yourself from that, filling up the crepe with that and then wrapping the whole thing, kind of like a fajita, an outsized fajita, inside either a leaf of lettuce or a leaf of mustard.
Oh, my goodness.
And you bite into it almost like a little sandwich.
Where else, though, between those two extremes of Hanoi and Saigon, where would you have us go? And what about the dishes maybe we've never heard of?
Well, up in the town of Hoi An, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, it's this beautiful little fishing village by the seaside in the central coast of Vietnam. Hoi An is really famous for a very unique regional cuisine. You have dishes there that are never found anywhere else in the country, let alone beyond Vietnam. And one of the most famous of those is called cao lao, which is, by legend, only to be made using water from one of a few local wells in Hoi An proper. There's a couple of families that control the water, and this water is what's used to make these wonderful, almost soba-like noodles. They're made of rice, but they taste so hearty and thick that they're like buckwheat. These thick, beautiful cao lao noodles are the base of this soup, and then on top of that, you add layers of grilled pork, often other meat, fish sauce, of course, and all sorts of layers of fresh herbs and cooked herbs and spices.
Oh, it sounds fabulous. Gotta go. Peter, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Peter John Lindbergh's article, Vietnam, the Ultimate Food Tour, was in the July 2010 issue of Travel and Leisure magazine. Now, there's a recipe that captures those flavors that he talked about. It's from Vietnamese chef Mai Pham. Lemongrass beef on cool noodles is on the website, splendidtable.org. Hey, and while you're there, download our podcast and sign up for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, you're going to get a quick recipe for weeknight suppers and cooking tips and thoughts on what's new and worth checking out. So you can register online, splendidtable.org. You know the way Peter John Lindbergh knows Vietnam? Well, Jane and Michael Stern know the side roads of America. Now, they report into their road food site, and they come by to talk with us. Jane, Michael, I have missed you. Where have you been?
We have been cruising along Highway 13 on the eastern shore of Virginia between Temperanceville and Modest Town.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding.
Between and they didn't kick us out.
Neither of which I can connect with the two
but
of
what you. But Lynn, I guarantee what we all can connect with is if we're driving along the road and we're in the town of Mapsville, which is between those two, we're going to see a bunch of very handmade, hand-painted signs along the side of the road calling out soft crabs, steamed shrimp, fried fish, oysters, and homemade crab cakes. That we can relate to, right?
Oh, gosh, can we relate to it?
At this place, let me tell you, it's a shack. I mean, if you look in the encyclopedia under Seafood Shack, there would be Metomkin Seafood. That's the name of this place. It closes from about January, I think, into April. But we happened to go there the first weekend they had been opened up, and people had come there from literally 2 hours away.
It's a destination place.
It is, even though seating is picnic table simple. You know, it's you step up to the counter, place your order. Ellen Hudgens, who runs the place, takes the order in back. They mm-hmm. cook the food. It's not fast food. It takes a while. You grab your own. You pay for it, which is like it's criminally cheap.
Like $3.95.
Yeah, $5 for a hearty meal. You take it out to a picnic table, eat, and dispose of your plates, and that's it. So it's very simple, but it is quintessentially great Eastern Shore seafood.
Are they actually on the water or close to the water?
Close. I mean, they're not actually, you don't see the water from there. But, you know, at this point, the Eastern Shore is so thin that it's you can smell it on either side of you.
You know, I think even if the water was, you know, 3 feet away, the customers there are so focused on getting their meal that they wouldn't even notice that there is water, you know, right in front of them. Remember the guy in the camouflage suit who we were in line with? He had been waiting.
Did he creep out of the seagrass and sneak into line?
I mean, he was dressed for action, but he
might have come from hunting. I don't know.
That could have been not hunting seafood.
No, probably right. Not.
But the person who takes the order said, "Do you have a good appetite?" And he said, "I've been hungry since Christmas." And you kind of got the feeling that coming here was, you know, this guy's highlight of his year.
Do they only do the seafood? I mean, do they do great desserts? I mean, is there something else there? Not that this is not enough, but I'm just...
No, there is. It's seafood. And I believe they make French fries. If they do, we didn't pay any attention to them. You know, it's a place you can buy seasoning and obviously buy the raw seafood to take home and cook it. I mean, that's really its primary purpose in life. But as far as side dishes, desserts, appetizers, wine lists, forget about it.
Yeah, it's not a full service restaurant. I mean,
it's funny. There is one table in the restaurant. I mean, there are the picnic tables outside. There is one round table in the restaurant equipped with a local phone book and a Bible and a remote control for the one TV overhead.
Thank you, guys.
All right, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern have turned their travels into the book 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can get their latest finds on the site, splendidtable.org. The past couple of weeks, I've been improvising a sort of stew in a roasting pan, but it's less work than stew, and it gives you something that's missing in stews: crisp roasted meat and vegetables, and then a sauce that's vaguely caramelized, so the flavors are big. I mean, really big. And this is really easy. So you need a large roasting pan, like a half sheet pan. You put your chunks of meat or a cut up chicken all over that pan. You throw in the vegetables and then you pour a sauce over it. And that sauce could be tomato sauce or a marinade. Right now I'm in my soy sauce period. So I'm mixing soy with wine, balsamic, some sugar, garlic, a little kick of chili. And you pour that over everything. You want enough to coat the pan. And then you slow roast. And you can eat this hot from the oven, but it's even better when you take it and you let it sit in that sauce overnight in the fridge. So there's a recipe on the site to start with. It's called Slow Roasted Chicken in Sweet Soy Braising Sauce. Go to splendidtable.org. Now we're going to be back in a minute with the Uptown Pancake and a handful of raisins in a war zone. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Dory Greenspan is one of those writers who makes you want to march in the kitchen and grab a pot. And she spends a lot of time in a place where good eating is a way of life. It's called Paris. Dory's a Francophile of the first order, and she's put it all on paper in her book, Around My French Table. Dory, it's so good to have you back.
Always good to be with you.
Dory, do French cooks make their own crepes, you know, at home?
I've seen one person do it over 30 years or so.
Really?
Well, you know, crepes are really, yes, people make them at home very occasionally. You can buy them on street corners. They're really an outdoor snack. And you can also buy them at the local equivalent of 7-Eleven. Every supermarket has. I know, it's really, I mean, this is why it's so much fun to shop in France. French cooks, French home cooks, are more likely to make savory pancakes at home. Not breakfast pancakes, but vegetable pancakes that would be side dishes or first courses.
Huh.
And there are, of course, I mean, you can't think of the French without thinking of potatoes. I think they're just geniuses at using potatoes. And so you see potato galettes, and they might be grated potatoes, what my grandmother would have called latkes, they would call galette, or kind of like Swiss rosti.
Yeah, but where the grated potato is made into a flat pancake. And
into a flat pancake.
Yeah.
And cooked stovetop in some oil or some butter. But there's a mashed potato pancake that I just love, and I love the name of it. It's called matafin. And the name comes from matin, morning,
right,
and fin meaning hunger. And this was food that was given to farm workers to tide them over during the day. It's a hearty, hearty pancake, and it's made by taking a potato and roasting it on salt in the oven until it's really, really dry. And then you make mashed potatoes out of that, and then you fry it. You sauté it, really. And the potatoes puff so that you get this beautiful, light, thick potato galette. And it's a great dish to serve with anything that has a little bit of sauce or gravy.
So it's just the mashed potatoes? It's not a batter?
It's mashed potatoes, and you separate eggs so it puffs because of the beaten whites. And there's some hot milk in it. It is so delicious. It's very plain. It's not flavored with anything other than salt and pepper. But it's the texture is so great. And it's just a terrific, terrific side dish.
Dory, what about corn? Do the French do corn pancakes?
Actually, they do. You know, it's funny. Canned corn is a really, really popular ingredient in France. Every once in a while, you can find a corn on the cob in the market, but it looks like it's been, you know, flown over from Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
But canned corn is used a lot. And corn pancakes, I had them years ago. Jean-Georges Vongerichten had made them for me maybe 20 years ago, more than that now, when he first came to New York. And I had them in a little country inn. And they take corn with eggs and a tiny little bit of flour, salt, put it in the food processor and just make a chunky mix of it. And then cook it in a skillet. And they're so much better than they really have any right to be.
Yeah,
because there's really nothing in them.
So how would you use those corn pancakes?
Well, I would serve them with chicken. I'd serve them with chicken or pork. They're a side dish. But you know what? They're awfully good with a little bit of caviar on them. You know, just as a very, very special occasion hors d'oeuvre with, of course, a glass of champagne.
Not a bad idea. Can you make these things ahead? Do you have to do them the last minute?
This is what's so great about these things. Yes, you can make them ahead. You can freeze them. And I have a recipe that I just love. It's called farceau. And it's a Swiss chard pancake that comes out brilliantly green. It's so beautiful. And so I make them, I serve them, and I freeze the leftovers. And they can just be defrosted and put in the oven anytime you want to serve them. But the color is so beautiful that it always makes me so happy to open the freezer and see them almost sparkling in there. And they're really, really delicious. And often they're served as a meal. You'll make a big Swiss chard pancake and just serve it with some salad.
Sounds great.
It's delicious.
Dory, thank you.
Always good to be with you.
Dory Greenspan's book is Around My French Table, and that recipe for Swiss chard pancakes, well, it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Journalist Anna Bodkin covers wars. She's spent years embedded in Iraq. She's been in Afghanistan. She's picked her way through minefields, been held at gunpoint, and experienced what it's like to have a $50,000 price on her head, courtesy of the Taliban. It's no surprise that Anna is not a sentimentalist. Yet the book that she chose to write is called Piecemeals, Candy-Wrapped Kalashnikovs and Other War Stories. Anna, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You know, at first glance, a book about food and war reporting, of all things, it seems really odd. Can you explain the link for us?
You know, Lynn, I think that the way we're all united, people here in the United States and people in the most direst of a failed state, is by the common need we have to eat. At the end of the day, if we're lucky, we're going to have something to eat. And the idea was to take the reader beyond the bang-bang that we see plenty of on television and mm-hmm. in newspapers and talk about the very, very humane stories that continue to happen in any place. People continue to fall in love, they fall out of love, they quarrel, they have babies, they get married. Because I felt the need to explain to people who are so far removed from war zones that people on the other side are very much like them, so that they're able to connect, and next time they see a firefight on television or a bomb going off, they can imagine the people on the other side who are living in that.
You know, there's something I'd love to have you read from the book, and it's the beginning of a particular chapter, Candy-Wrapped Kalashnikovs. Could you read the beginning of that for us?
Sure. It's the beginning of chapter 4. High on Valium and potent Afghan hashish, Najibullah balanced his Kalashnikov rifle on his left shoulder and reached for the jalebi, a pyramid of honey-colored deep-fried rings of hot, syrupy dough stacked on a street vendor's dusty aluminum folding table by the side of a potholed dirt road. He hooked one jalebi with his long index finger, raised it above his head, lifted his bearded face, and, crooning a Bollywood jingle in a tentative falsetto, began to nibble at the sugary donut like some tropical bird, swaying slightly to the rhythm of a song that he alone could follow.
This is a take on food in war that I found pretty unexpected. What's the story behind this?
Well, Najibullah, a gorgeous and a very troubled young man, a fighter, had been given to me by the warlord co-manager of a hotel where I was staying in Jalalabad near Tora Bora in 2001 when Osama bin Laden and about 1,000 Al-Qaeda fighters and Taliban fighters were believed to be hiding in Tora Bora in the mountains. And I was basically told that in order to be able to report from the region, from the area, I had to hire Najibullah and pay not him but his commander $25 a day. I think it was a sort of another way of making money on journalists. And Najibullah turned out to be an absolutely amazing guide to so many things. First of all, this is a man, he was in his mid-20s. He had been fighting since he was 12. He was a portrait of an Afghan man who just found himself swept away by the conflicts that keep rolling across the Afghan mountains and plains there. And he fought against the Soviets, and then he fought against the Taliban, and now he was, now for a moment, he was out of work because American Special Forces had taken over the fight. Uh-huh. And he basically showed me what the life of the foot soldiers that American forces were using in Afghanistan to rout out the Taliban, what their lives were like. And he, because he smoked a lot of hashish, he had a bit of a sweet tooth. So he also introduced me to jalebi, which is, as I described, sort of Afghan donuts.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And the idea of sugar and war, somehow that combination is just, it clashes in my mind. Sugar, the treat, and the life
sugar
that's
the
being
treat.
Led. Yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah. also, you know, cheap energy. And as I later found out, you know, there is also an alternative use of candy wraps. When a group of gunmen, whom I was also told to hire to accompany me on a very dangerous road, which we had dubbed the Death Road. You right. know, every country has the Death Road. When my five bodyguards turned their guns at me to demand more money, and I realized that they had wrapped the barrels of their Kalashnikovs with Hubba Bubba wrappers and Donald Duck stickers out of chewing gum packages and dum-dums. And I thought, really? I'm going to be killed by a gun that's screaming at me with yellow and pink and blue? And it was sort of surreal. But very, you know, wars are surreal.
That is utterly surreal. Are there any moments of sitting down at the table with people that really haunt you?
Well, first of all, an American army colonel once told me that people who go through a war with you are a small fraternity. And being together with someone in extremity is a very strong bond. And sharing meal at the end of the day with people who, you know, people who work with me are risking their lives. And after I'm gone, they continue to risk their lives because that they live in a war zone. It's just they can't leave. Yeah. They don't have a place to go. And sharing a meal is one of the most elemental ways of expressing that sense that we're family. We're the closest of friends. We will, you know, if it comes to that, we will die in each other's arms. We will be the last people we see. And the meals differ so much. They vary so much. There were these amazing, lavish meals that looked like wedding feasts that Iraqi soldiers threw for a unit of American soldiers with which I was embedded in 2005. And then there was a pit stop I made in a small Afghan village in 2001. The village was about to starve. Because they had no food, they had no access to food. It had been a long, long drought. The nearest market town was 17 hours of on foot, and they had no cars. And I stopped by a little lean-to that served as a shop that just sold necessities, you know, soap and matches and olive oil. Mm-hmm. And the owner was just about to close the shop for the winter because there was absolutely no need for his wares, because if you don't have anything to cook with cooking oil, then who needs it?
Yeah.
And because I was passing through, he saw me as a guest, and so he automatically became the host. So he shared, you know, he didn't have any food either, but he shared with me what he could, and it was a fistful of these gnarled green, really dry raisins. And he sort of poured those raisins into my palm and apologized that he couldn't give me anything more. And these raisins, Lynn, were worth every single plate at that huge Iraqi table in an Iraqi army base, because he was giving away, possibly a sustenance for a day to me, a complete stranger. And these gestures are what makes... These gestures are what reminds me that we're human and reminds me that we're human even in the most dire circumstances.
Anna, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Anna Bodkin's book is Peace Meals. Now, find a recipe for that Afghan sweet jalebi on the website, splendidtable.org.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
It is time to turn to your questions. Get on the line at 800-537-5252. You can friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Mike is calling from Minneapolis. Mike, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm just puzzled about what to do when I get a recipe that calls just for red wine or white wine, and what do I use out of the hundreds of choices available, and what do I keep around the kitchen for that purpose?
What do you usually use?
Well, I usually try to take a guess at what might work and then find something that I had purchased to drink and cook with that and then drink the rest of the bottle. But
you're right on the nose. You'd never want to cook with anything you wouldn't drink. You
know, that I know.
Yeah, which you hear all the time. But what I keep around is fairly inexpensive but not cheap, in quotation marks.
Right.
I keep a Merlot or a Shiraz or a Malbec, coming from the places where wine is inexpensive generally.
You know? Okay.
Yeah, so it's coming usually not from California or France, that kind of thing. And that's usually my red. I want it to have some real body behind it. I want it to have some tannins in it.
Sure.
And then for the white wine, I usually have some kind of Sauvignon Blanc. It's a dry white that has some character. So it could be something from New Zealand. It could be a Sauvignon Blanc from almost anywhere. And I generally don't spend on those wines more than about $7 or $8 a bottle. And they're good drinking wines. They're good everyday drinking wines. But what you want is something that has structure, that when you taste it, you kind of get body, you get acidity, because you really need acidity in cooking to stand up, you know, to the other flavors.
Okay. And then how long can I keep a wine around after it's been opened in the refrigerator or something to cook with?
Well, one of the great things to do, there is, and that they're not wildly expensive, there are these, it's like a cylinder that you pump gas. It's a tasteless gas that you can pump into that open bottle so that you have a layer that's protecting the surface of that wine, you know, in the half-filled bottle, from the air, because air is what changes the wine.
Right.
Air and heat. That's around and you can find it. The other thing I do is I keep it in the fridge, and I usually try to not keep them longer than maybe a week.
So you think a week old wine is fine to cook with?
It can be. Taste it first, but I think it can be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. And just, you know, don't spend a lot of money, but there's so much good and expensive wine out there.
Right. Well, I know that the things I've kept around to drink are usually, I don't want to pour them on a $5 pot roast. So.
Hey, thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Take care. Now, we're going to get back to your questions in a moment, but first, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. And the question is, what's the latest must-have piece of equipment for the modern chef? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're going to be back to your calls in a few minutes, so get in touch. Connect with us on Facebook. Give us a call, 800-537-5252, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. But for right now, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what is the latest must-have piece of equipment for the modern chef? It's tweezers. There is now a tweezer cuisine, named by, I think, an equally bemused restaurant critic. Now, here's the thing. You can only see tweezer cuisine in action in very expensive restaurants. The places that serve, as another food writer said, international rich person food. The press is having a ball with this. Okay, the official definition is Tweezer cuisine is where chefs hover over a dish, arranging the tiniest bits and strands. It is breathtakingly cutting edge to some and breathtakingly scary to others. Those talented souls are breathing all over our dinner. Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or check us out on Facebook or send an email, splendidtable.org. We have got Diane calling from Pittsburgh. Diane, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about mojitas.
Oh, a mojitete. I think I'm pronouncing correctly. You mean the three-legged Mexican mortar and pestle?
That's right.
Aha. Okay. You have one?
I bought one after I listened to your show, and Dory Greenspan recommended you using a mortar and pestle for guacamole and salsa.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And also grinding your own spices in it.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I grind all my spices. I mean, when I really have a lot of them, I'll use a coffee grinder. But I grind spices in them. It grinds so easily and so well. So what's your question?
Well, my question is that I've realized that there's a lot of grit within the grooves of the porous rock.
Yes.
Other people have told me they can never get that grit out, and they are disappointed that they even bought it. So my question is, what is the best way to clean and season this mortar before the first use?
Okay. Now, I have to tell you, if it's a very low-grade one, it's hard to get the grit out. But and one of the ways you can tell, because it is slightly porous, is if you put water in it and the water seeps out the bottom or down the legs, you want to return it.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but now a new one will have grit in it. And one of the way you start out is wash it with warm water and rinse it really well and dry it completely. Just let it air dry. And then what you're supposed to do is you can take rice, just raw rice, and grind it so that you're using both sides of the pestle. And then it's going to turn gray from all of that grit. Rinse it out, dry it completely, and then do it again another couple of times until the rice is just a white powder.
Oh, okay.
Now, the way you're supposed to take care of it is you wash it out with soap and water, thoroughly rinsing it every time you use it. And the same thing with the pestle. And then you just dry it completely, air dry it. And that's it. And it's going to take a little time to do that. But once you do, the one I treasure, quite a long time ago, I was doing a station visit to San Antonio, Texas. And a man at the station, a lovely man, his mother had passed away. And he and his sister gave me her mojitete that was 20-some years old. And so it's like having this wonderful, wonderful woman in my kitchen. And it was seasoned for me. So I didn't have to go through this. But I have to tell you, it is a tool I must use 5 times a week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I grind, I do garlic in it. I have some cumin seeds I want to grind. But it's so good. It feels so good to do it, and it smells wonderful. And no machine equals it. I mean, call it romance, but that's what cooking can be about.
Oh,
so just have a little patience now, you know.
Okay.
And once you do, you're going to just love it. You're going to find yourself using it for a lot of things.
Very good.
Okay?
Okay, thanks a million.
Enjoy it.
Thank you.
Call us 800-537-5252. Go online, splendidtable.org. Let's see, who's up? We've got Lauren calling from Nashville. Lauren, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. It's so good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got something fun in my hand that's actually made in Nashville, and it's fun for fall. It's pumpkin spice moonshine. It's a whiskey. It's made from barley and wheat. It's very high alcohol. It's like 42%, and it definitely has that alcoholic burn when you drink it. But it smells like baked pumpkin. And it says that in the still, they put like cinnamon and cloves and nutmeg and all that wonderful stuff. And it's a little spicy, but it's very warm tasting. And I was just wondering if you had any ideas of stuff to mix with it, or anything I could bake would be awesome too.
Okay, so you've got pumpkin spice, essentially, pumpkin pie spice. You know, okay, there's a couple of things you could do. First of all, a couple of tablespoons literally going into your pumpkin pie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you could just do a pumpkin pie filling. And, oh, wait, I've just had a brainstorm. Okay. So here's the deal. If you make your pumpkin pie filling, whatever you like to do, okay, add a tablespoon or so of this to the pumpkin pie filling. Put the pumpkin pie filling in coffee cups, maybe, and you take a baking pan, okay, that can hold those cups comfortably. Fold a towel in the bottom of it. That's your cushion. Put the coffee cups in the pan, and then put them on the rack in the oven. Have the oven at about 325.
Okay.
Pour boiling or very hot water carefully into that pan so it comes about halfway up the side of the cups. And then what you do is you bake it until when you put a knife blade in the center, you know, it comes out fairly clean.
Okay.
Leave them just sitting there with the oven door open. Don't try to take them hot out of that water.
Okay.
Just leave them sit there. And then you can serve them right from the oven. You can chill them and serve them the next day. But when you serve them, flame a little bit of that whiskey over each one of those servings.
Yeah.
You know?
That sounds really good.
Yeah. The other thing you could do is make what they call a hard sauce to go on that, which would be cooking the whiskey with butter and vanilla and sugar.
That'd be really good, I
think. And making a sauce with it is a great way to go because you cook off some of the alcohol.
Some of the burn.
Oh, I think you're going to have a fun time with this.
Yeah, me too.
Hey, Lauren, thanks for calling.
Thanks for talking to me.
You take care. We've got Scott up, and he's calling from Cape Cod. Scott, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lynn, how are you doing? I'm so excited to be talking to you. I love your show. You've really upped my game.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. What is your game?
Well, I have a little project I've dreamed up and been inspired to do partly by you and others to do a big family gathering down on the beach for an old-fashioned New England clam bake.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. I haven't been to one of those in ages.
I mean, I've looked into it. I've done a little research. I know the basics, you know, about you dig the pit, you build the fire,
right,
you put the seaweed down, lobsters, steamers, corn, potatoes. But what I wanted to talk to you about was anything else, you know, that you think might be fun to put into the pit with the basic thing.
I've seen people throw in sausages. And, you know, at this time of year, you're going to do this now, right? You know,
if I don't run out of time, it might be a spring thing if I have to.
Because, you know, if you're doing it in cold weather, there's no reason why, along with the potatoes, you couldn't do thin sliced parsnips and carrots. You know, the really local stuff that you've got.
Yeah, great because, turnip squash now.
Yeah, exactly.
Any ideas on how to class it up a little bit? I don't know, sauces to prepare? Or
well, you know, if you want to get very European, it seems like a sacrilege, but if you want to get very European, one of the great things with shellfish is this combination of vinegar, wine vinegar, you minced up shallots, black pepper, some salt, and a bit of olive oil, and you dip into that. But of course, the great thing is melted butter.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the great thing. And I mean, you could add stuff to that butter, like fresh herbs, you know, dill would be great. Basil would be fabulous, or lemon. And I could put lemon wedges around. But you're talking about one of the most wonderful American traditions. I would stay with the traditional stuff.
Yeah, keep it simple.
Yeah, I hate to be a bore, but I think it would be fabulous. I mean, I'm just picturing the plate, you know, piled with that, with the open shells of those clams and hunks of lobster and all the vegetables. And then, you know, you just have a big pot of melted butter. I always like to add, if you get some of the juices from that pan that everything's roasting on, add some of those juices. But the idea is everybody gets a, you know, a little cup or something of that melted butter. And I used to just pour it all over everything.
That's a great idea. I'll definitely do that.
Okay.
Lynn, great advice. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm picturing you guys out on the beach.
I'll send you an invitation.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. Bye, Lynn.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. You know, mom and apple pie may be the sentimental side of America, but we are a country of cakes, going back a long way. I mean, take a look at the 19th century cookbooks and you're going to see what I mean. Well, anyway, a Washington baker, Warren Brown, discovered that there are state cakes. He's tracked down old-time cakes all over the country for his book, The United Cakes of America. Hey, Warren, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
You know, this book revealed something I was clueless about. There are actually state cakes?
Oh, yeah, yeah. People are celebrating baking all across the country, officially and unofficially. And some legislators have actually recognized the cultural value of some of the cakes and some of the baking. And it's a great tribute, I think, because people put a lot of time and effort into baking, and there's a lot that a lot we get out of it, too.
So I mean, what states have cakes?
Oh, yeah. Well, South Dakota's got the Kuchen. They wanted to recognize their cultural heritage. But the same in Maryland. The Smith Island cake was recently passed, in 2008. Smith Island cake is the official state cake.
What kind of cake is that?
It's kind of funny. In some ways, it might be an abomination for people who love to bake from scratch. It's really a yellow cake, and a lot of recipes call for using a box cake, just kind of doctoring it up. But basically yellow cake with chocolate buttercream and chocolate icing, but a bit of a special kind of, I think somewhat sweet chocolate filling between multiple layers of cake. It's fun to
make. So it's a lot of thin layers with a lot of chocolate. Well, that doesn't sound too bad. What are some of the other ones?
Well, one of the ones that I like and is really common, people will know, of course, is Boston cream pie, official state cake for Massachusetts. And, there's nothing more simple, more basic than good old vanilla cake, vanilla pastry cream covered in chocolate ganache. That's what that one is. It's beautiful, it's easy to make, and everyone loves that one. So we've got a variety of different kind of cakes that come out as state official ones. But then, of course, it's really neat, I think, to focus on, what people are making and what people love but aren't officially recognized.
You know, the thing I found really interesting is Tennessee's cake, stack cake.
Yeah, that's another one that really surprised me. And I was doing the research for this, of course. I didn't know about all these cakes, and the apple stack cake is one I had never even heard of before, and most people I meet haven't. It's a thin layers of almost like a cookie dough that's the cake part. And you really roll out this dough, bake it. It's like a molasses cookie. They're very firm. They're almost like a Frisbee in a way. And once you bake those and set them aside, you have to take this reconstituted apple filling. So you take apples and you dry them, and you really have to dehydrate them rather than just leave them out or even get applesauce. You got to dry these apples.
Right.
Long process. But then you'll bring them back to life with some sugar and some little bit of spices and kind of cook it. And that's going to be the filling between these layers.
Wow.
And it's unlike anything I've ever had. I mean, it's more powerful than like apple preserves or apple sauce. I mean, it's delicious stuff. And once you assemble the cake, you wrap it up so that the moisture from the apple filling can penetrate into the molasses cake layers and soften them up a little bit. And you're really better off if you wait a couple of days, 1 to 2 or 3 days even. Yeah, it's all in the fridge during this time, but it's waiting for, the big party. And when you take it out and serve it, if people haven't seen this before, they're definitely going to take a step back and be like, well, what exactly do we do with this?
Hey, Warren, thank you.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Warren Brown's book is United Cakes of America, and we have got his recipe for that stack cake, Tennessee Mountain Stack Cake, and it's on the website splendidtable.org. Well, we're done for this week. Thanks for joining us, and remember, you can get to us any way, anytime. Have a great week, and let me leave you with this poem from Margaret Sangster. Of cakes and friends, we should choose with care. Not always the fanciest cake that's there is the best to eat. And the plainest friend is sometimes the finest in the end. The
Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. You'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Be sure to get registered for our monthly book giveaway. This month, it's an autographed copy of our new book, How to Eat Weekends. And check out our series of special podcasts called How to Eat Weekends, as well as our new blog. And you'll find it all, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone-Getton. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a great one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.